Okay, this week is Parshat Mishpatim. One of the pieces of intrigue which we have discussed in the past, which we're just going to use as a starting point, is the relationship between Parshat Mishpatim and Parshat Yitro. So just to focus a little bit, it starts off, Ve'ela HaMishpatim. And these are the Mishpatim. Rashi writes in source number 2, Kol Makom Shenemar Eile Poselet HaRishonim. That whenever it says Eile, it means to the exclusion of what was before that. Ve'ele, on the other hand, when it says ve'ele, as in this case, ve'ele mishpatim, it's not coming to, in contrast to the previous, ela, ve'ele mosif ala rishonim, it's coming to add. Maha rishonim misinai, just as the original, the first, meaning the Ten Commandments, were from Sinai, af elu misinai, these two commandments are considered to be from Sinai. V'lama nismacha parsha din l'parsha mizbeach lom lacha chetasim sanhedrin etzel hamikdash, which is a very interesting conclusion for Rashi to draw, that he's telling us that there's some kind of what we would call connection between in the narrative. So the last thing we finished off was things about building a Mizbeach after the Ten Commandments, going on to the Mishpatim, telling us that we need there to be near the Beit HaMikdash, there needs to be a court, even the high court needs to sit. Parenthetical remark, if you don't have a Beit HaMikdash, then you don't have a Sanhedrin, at least for some of the laws, most likely for all of the laws. That it's like the capital. You need the capital in order to certain aspects of government. Again, what Rashi therefore is telling us is that the Mishpatim that we have over here somehow follow the Ten Commandments. And again, that should be very, very simple. The challenge in Parshat Mishpatim, or one of the challenges, is Perek Kaf Dalet. So let's just focus for a second. We're up to Perek Kaf Aleph. Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, and Kaf Gimel all deal with law. Perek Kaf Dalet is narrative, which goes back and discusses the Matan Torah. The challenge then is what is the relationship between Perek Kaf Dalet and Perek Yutet and Perek Kaf? I will give you first two opinions, and then we'll devolve into three opinions, and then we're going to come, and then maybe a fourth opinion, but they're not all mutually exclusive. According to Rashi, you need to open up Perek Yutet and Perek Kaf Dalet and read them together. And not just read them together, because if you want to understand them, you need to read them together with Rashi. You'll then understand that according to Rashi, Perek Kaf Dalet is interdispersed within Yutet, and Kaf Dalet takes place chronologically the same time as Yutet. Okay, so that's the first point. Therefore, according to Rashi, when did Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, and Kaf Gimel take place? Well, if Kaf Dalet, I hope you're still with me, Kaf Dalet is with Yutet, that means that Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, and Kaf Gimel are after Yutet, but where do they fit into this? So I'm going to make this a little easier now. According to Rashi, Moshe Rabbeinu goes up at the end of Kaf Dalet to receive the Torah up in heaven, and what does God teach him? The shir that God gives him is on Perek Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, and Kaf Gimel, and what he's learning right then is Parshat Mishpatim. That's the content of what takes place while Moshe goes up. I'm not saying it's exclusively the content. I'm not saying that nothing else was taught, but I'm saying that's the way the things follow. Ve'ela Mishpatim follows the Ten Commandments, but according to Rashi, the Ten Commandments take place, right, again, to be careful, Kaf Dalet, which tells us how Moshe goes up, that is prior to Perek Kaf Aleph, and that goes together with the end of Perek Kaf, which means the Ten Commandments themselves. So I hope that was clear. Why is any of this important? Which means, according to Rashi, when the Jews in Kaf Dalet say Na'aseh V'Nishma, what were they responding to? So according to Rashi, Perek Kaf Dalet is prior to Perek Kaf and Kaf Aleph and Kaf Pet and Kaf Gimel, which means what are they responding to? So specifically, the Pasuk is going to say that the Jews say Na'aseh V'Nishma. We'll come back and read the Pasuk B'li Neder in a moment with the Ramban's understanding. The Jews say Na'aseh V'Nishma. What do they say Na'aseh V'Nishma to? They say it to no knowledge whatsoever. According to Rashi, the biblical story is in Bereshit. According to Rashi, the Sheva Mitzvah B'nei Noach, which should not be all that special, according to Rashi, then the mitzvah that were given at Marah, which means Shabbat could be added, Paraduma, some others, Dinim, which means according to Rashi, there's a very, very small amount of information. So essentially, there's a total leap of faith. It's a total leap of faith that the Jews go through, and I'll come back to that in a moment. According to the Ramban, and there's a secret to remembering the Ramban and understanding the Ramban. What's the secret? Everything's in order. That's the secret. Okay, there you go. Now you got the Ramban. Everything is in order. If you want to see the Ramban describe this and explain this, a really interesting treatment is in the very beginning of Parsha Yitro, when it says Vayavo Yitro. The Ibn Ezra there has a long, totally convincing argument why Parsha Yitro took place after Matan Torah. Right? Completely, completely convincing argument. His reasonings are, well, look when Yitro comes in terms of other information we have in the Chumash. Look when he comes, look when he goes. What is Moshe doing judging the people from day to night? This has to be later. What's the content of which he's dealing with? And he gives other pieces of information as well, why this has to be later. Now, to pause there for a moment, the Ramban then quotes the Ibn Ezra and essentially admits that this is real interesting and vital information, but he just can't agree. At the end of the day, he can't agree, and he, no, the Torah is in its proper sequence. I mean, all that is interesting, but we need to find better answers because it's an axiom. The Torah is in its proper sequence, and that seems to be the way that the Ramban starts, beginnings, and ends. It's in the right sequence. So now, when we keep that information, we come now up to Perek of Dalid. Well, Rashi claimed, if you're with me, that Parshat Mishpatim comes after, that's the content that we learn up on Sinai. According to the Ramban, that's not a viable explanation. Why? Because everything in its proper sequence. So God says the Ten Commandments. Then God says to Moshe, all of Parshat Mishpatim, let's focus now on Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, Kaf Gimel, all of those laws. And then in Kaf Dalet, what happens? Well, I'll read to you the Pasuk, which I don't believe you have in front of you. It says, Vayavo Moshe v'yisaper l'amet kol devrei Hashem v'tkol ha-mishpatim. Moshe comes and says everything that God said and all the Mishpatim. So what happened? God started saying the Ten Commandments. We don't know how far he went. According to Rashi, he only went as far as two. According to the Pshat, seems to be he says all ten. The people, after saying all ten, says, listen, we can't take this anymore. Again, Rashi, he only said two. Ramban, that comes after God said all ten. They say to Moshe, you speak to God. So Moshe says, fine. And then God tells him the rest of the Mishpatim. What happens then? Moshe comes back. Vayavo Moshe v'yisaper la'amet kol divrei Hashem v'etkol mishpatim. Vayana am kol echad v'yomer kol d'masher diber Hashem na'aseh. So the people's response to hearing the Ten Commandments and then hearing the mishpatim is they say na'aseh. Vayichtov Moshe kol divrei Hashem. And then Moshe writes down Parshat Mishpatim, Sarat Dibro Parshat Mishpatim, which again we can understand everything till this point. And then it goes to this whole conversion process, sprinkling of the blood and so on. Vayikach Sefer Habrit. Moshe takes the Book of the Covenant, which according to the Ramban, what book is it? It's the book which contains Aseret Dibrot and Parshat Mishpatim. V'yikra b'znei ha'am, and he reads it to the people. V'yomu kol asher diber Hashem, na'aseh v'nishma. Everything which God said, na'aseh v'nishma. Do you realize how terrible the Ramban is, what he just now did? He totally ruined the na'aseh v'nishma for us. We are all raised based upon the Gemara's perspective that na'aseh v'nishma was with no information whatsoever. And we said, sure, we'll do it. We don't know what it is. And the Ramban just totally ruined it because they just now learned through all of the Aseret Dibrot and Parshat Mishpatim. Those of you who don't realize this, if you would take my Parshat Mishpatim and turn it into Mishnayot, right? Go and look a Mishnah for each point over there. You can have a good point, a good deal of Shas over there. Friend of mine, he wasn't trying to brag about his learning, he was bragging about how long the gas lines were. In 1975, if you remember, there were these long, 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 long gas lines. So a friend of mine today, he's very important, Rosh Hashiva, Rosh Kolel, Rav Yitzchak Berkowitz. So he told me that waiting on the gas line, he learned through the entire Parshat Mishpatim with the Torah Tamima. So the Torah Tamima is every single quote of every single Gemara with every single comment. That's a lot of material. The Torah Tamima on Mishpatim. Yeah. The real point was how long the line was, but it's still a very effective way to use your time. But the point is that there's just so much content over here, and according to the Ramban, the Na'aseh v'nishma was to the content which they heard. The third opinion among the Rishonim, it echoes a machlok which already existed among the Tanayim. So you already find in Mechilta these different opinions. Third opinion is the Chizkuni. And the Chizkuni says, so what does it mean, the Sefer HaBrit? So he sends you all the way to the end of Vayikra, to the Tochacha, to Parshat Bechukotai, when it says at the very, very end, and then you remember the covenant, right? The Brit, which I forged together. He goes, that's the Brit. According to the Chizkuni, what the people said Naseh v'nishma to was Parshat Bichukotai, hearing the Tochacha, hearing what's going to happen if you don't keep this covenant, all of the consequences. Which means, according to Rashi, let's put it like this, and I apologize in advance for everything I'm about to say. Yes? You accept this or no? You accept my apology? According to Rashi, essentially Matan Torah is a Hasidish wedding where they never met before. You know, they say that on Simchas Torah, when the Chasen Torah is, when they say it's a Hasidish Chasen, that means he never met the Kala. Right? It's not good on Simchas Torah. On Simchas Torah, you want to give somebody who's well acquainted with the Kala. According to the Ramban, it comes out. What do you want to say? You want to say it's more. You want to say it's more litvish, more modern. It's here. You have that they meet, and there's all the terms are set. This is what you need to do. This is all the responsibility. Which means, in a sense, you have the ksuva written. You know exactly what the responsibilities are. According to the Chizkuni, you essentially have a modern Orthodox wedding with a prenup. Here are the consequences when you don't keep this. This is what's going to happen to you right now. And so it makes a big difference what the Naseh V'Nishma was. Was the Naseh V'Nishma with not knowing anything, or was it knowing what the obligations are, or is it even knowing what the consequences are when you don't keep it? It makes a very big difference, although I can make an argument why each opinion is special. According to Rashi, obviously, maybe it's a little more romantic, total act of faith, a leap of faith. We accept God. We, you know, like the Psukim say, we ran off, Lech Techachrei, the Midbar, Be'eretz Lo Zeruah. The Jews, you know, are like a lovesick bride. We don't know what's going to, we don't know the contours of this relationship. We don't know what we're getting into, but we accept it. So that's beautiful. According to the Ramban, we accept it, but we know exactly what we're getting into. This is what we need to do, and that's Parashat Mishpatim. We need to know these laws. According to the Chizkuni, we see the contract and all the fine print with the lawyers stuck in, which person doing, what are the consequences when you broke this contract, and we accepted that upon ourselves. That's also a very interesting comment. So it's not a question of that one is a better interpretation than the other, but they're different interpretations from one another. Now, those are my three different ways of looking at the Naseh V'Nishma. Now, the Netziv adds in another comment, which is really, in a certain sense, an independent comment. And the Netziv, we have in source number 3. It's on Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Aleph. The El Moshe Amar, Perish Rashi, Kol Parsha Nemar Kol Demaseret HaDibrot. So he's citing the Rashi, telling us that Perek Kaf Dalet comes before Perek Kaf. That's what the Netziv just now did. For Ramban hitzametz laferesh, he liked his word lehitzametz. He had to work very hard to explain shahaya achar ken kiseder k'tuvim. And the Ramban works very hard to claim that the Torah is going to be in the order that it's written. And we'll skip a little bit. Should we skip it? Yeah. Vani tama al gaon Yisrael Ramban velo sugid gemar mufresh perek zayin pashut dechamishi bana mizbeach. He says, but it's against Chazal. By the way, this doesn't bother the Ramban. The Ramban often gives interpretations against Chazal. He doesn't get into as much trouble as the Ibn Ezra does. And I'll tell you exactly the reason for it. Because the Ramban will not go against Chazal when it comes to halacha. He will go against Chazal when it comes to narrative and explaining the narrative of something. The Ibn Ezra will say, well, this is pshat even sometimes when it's against accepted halacha. So the Ibn Ezra may not even do it as often as the Ramban does. It gets totally attacked for this. And the Ramban just does what he wants in terms of narrative. So the Netziv is a big question. But there's no opinion like this in Chazal. The Ramban would say, okay, but it's still pshat. Why are you confusing things? But he says, I'm shocked that the Gaon Yisrael, and he really was, the Ramban is incredibly impressive, v'lo sugi gemar shabbat, and so on, skipping next line, amnam b'dvar seder parsha, near the parsha, v'ed l'mashvatim gam kenemra lifnei hadibrot. So did you understand what he just now said? The Netziv claims that v'ed l'mashvatim was prior to the Aseret HaDibrot. It was worth coming today just for that. I never heard it either until I saw it this week. I'm looking, I say, what? He really says this. And he develops this in a couple of places. Or he certainly hints in a couple of places. This is the best place that he discusses it. But he takes it throughout the chapter. The Netziv believes that Perek Kaf Dalet and Perek Kaf Aleph of Kaf Bet and Kaf Gimel are connected back in Perek Yutet, which means they heard all of the Mishpatim prior to hearing the Aseret HaDibrot. So therefore, this becomes a very interesting, it's a thought. It's more than an approach in how we look at things rather than something which I think will have real implications in terms of halacha, which means, do we look at Parshat Mishpatim as somehow an expansion of the Aseret HaDibrot? And it's very easy to look at it that way. That's really what Rashi was starting us out in that direction. This is following it, and as you start to go through, you'll realize that there's going to be terms and words and phrases and ideas throughout Mishpatim, which then connect to the Aseret HaDibrot. Right? It's very easy. If you want homework, it's very easy to go home, take all of Parshat Mishpatim, take 10 categories, they're called the Aseret HaDibrot, and then say, okay, so which one does this fit into? What you're going to find, if you do this, it will be very easy to fit them in, but what you'll find, which I think is more interesting, is going to be the cross-referencing, is realizing that this mitzvah actually fits in with another one. Let me illustrate this just to understand this. Go back to source number one. Ve'elam mishpatim asher tasim lefneichem. So these are the laws, these are mishpatim. Ki tikna eved ivri, when you buy an eved ivri. So now the first thing is, which dibur did that immediately connect us to? Well, in a certain sense, to the first one. I am God who took you out of the house of slavery. So right away there's an Anochi reference. Sheshanim yavod v'shviyetzei chovshi. 6 years you work and the seventh you're free, which just now gave us some kind of what was the message there? It's a Shabbat. It's a Shabbat reference. Now it starts talking about marriage, which by the way could lead us to certain things in terms of lo tinaf. It continues, and then it says at the end, "Im yomar ha'eved ahavti et adoni et ishti ve'et banai lo etzich hafshi." I don't want to go. V'gishu et elo Elohim, v'gishu el adelet v'el mezuzah. Now that's something which actually takes us back to leaving Egypt. It takes us back to the door frame and so on. So the reference is used over here. Let me put it this way. Rashi is going to make an interesting comment on source number two. Rashi will say, "Asher tasim lefnechem," right on that first pasuk. He says, "Amar lo Kodesh Baruch Hu leMoshe." Right, this is the second paragraph in source two. Rashi, "Lo talel dat chalomer eshne lahem aperek valacha shnayim o shlosha pa'amim ad shitzdor b'fiim kimishnata ve'ini matriach atzmi lavinam ta'amei adavar ufirusho lekach nemar asher tasim lefnechem." Don't think you're just going to have to teach it two or three times, say the lesson, say it again, say it a third time, and move on. No, you have to work hard to explain it, to make sure the people understand it. And what's the metaphor that Rashi brings? People don't remember the metaphor, but the metaphor has great, great impact in Jewish history. He says, "Kishulchan ha'aruch," like a set table. This is where the idea of a shulchan aruch came from in terms of law, that from this Rashi, which is again based upon Chazal, that when you teach something, make it as a set table, make it as a shulchan aruch, in order to be easily accessed, easily understood. Teach things in a very clear manner. Umuchan lecho lefnei adam. You want to set it easily so that people can understand what's being taught. Now, if I were then to go to the Shulchan Aruch, which is just one frame of reference, Shulchan Aruch, you have Aruch Chaim and Eredeya and Eben Ezer and Chol Shem Mishpat. Aruch Chaim deals with daily law going all the way through Shabbat and holidays. Yeridea deals with prohibitions. We'll leave it there for the most part, including eating, including Chosh Mishpat deals with business law, and Eben Ezra deals with marriage laws. Now, if I just use that division of four, how many laws did I just now touch? Now, there's an important teaching that we don't know yet, and that is going, it's not in front of you, but that's going to be mentioned in the parasha. Perek Kaf Bet, Pasuk Bet. I'm going to read the second half of the Pasuk, where it says, Shalem Shalem, I know I'm jumping in the middle, Im Ein Lo, but if he doesn't have money to pay for his theft, B'nim Kar B'Gnevato, then he needs to be sold because of the theft that he did. That Pasuk is utilized back by the Gemara and then by the commentaries right back into the Pasuk about slavery, which means, again, Kitikna Eved Ivri. So where did this Eved Ivri come from? What is an Eved Ivri? An Eved Ivri is a Jew. An Eved Ivri is a Jew who was guilty of some kind of a crime. Okay, for the most part. That's what the Pasuk just now told us. He's guilty of a crime. Now let's pause for another moment. Just as far as what the Chumash is telling us. Because, again, you have a reference right here, one chapter to the other. I'm not saying this is exclusively the only way, but I'm saying this is what's referenced over here. In many legal systems, when somebody's guilty of a crime, so then what happens? So then they get incarcerated. So it could be that being put in prison is a very good thing. It could be a very bad thing. It could be that the main point of it is that it's a deterrent, even though I think most studies will show that it's not necessarily a deterrent. I mean, a lot of the things we think are a deterrent do not necessarily act as a deterrent for all kinds of reasons. We can have the psychologists discuss this, we can have our sociologists discuss it, we can have our lawyers discuss this, but it doesn't seem to really work as a deterrent. So what ends up happening is that the person who was robbed loses out on money. The state has to pay for the person to be incarcerated. While they're incarcerated, they meet other criminals, which means they can become, they have a nice chevra that they could now, you know, become friends with, and they can end up becoming hopefully a better criminal along the way and not get caught, and then you have the deterrent and not be arrested again. But the, you know, recidivism does exist, and the whole system over here is essentially you have you create more victims. Because the victimized person remains a victim, and then the family, and the state, and everybody becomes victimized in this. What the Torah over here is suggesting is something which is interesting, but there is a real assumption which is being made, and it's that assumption that I wanted to really focus on today. What the Torah is telling us is this person who's guilty of the crime should be sold as a servant. He's a Jew. Another Jewish family purchases this person. The Gemara is going to tell us details, the Tosfot quote, the Yerushalmi, how if you bought an Eved, you really bought a master, you have to treat them properly. If you have one pillow, you give it to him, and so on and so forth, which is trying to tell you something, that the person needs to be treated with decency. What the Torah is saying over here is something which is extremely, extremely liberal in its consequences, and a lot of us will recoil when I say what I'm going to say. I'm going to be guilty today of saying everything which you can possibly upset with, and in both directions. So just get ready. What the Torah seems to be saying is that the rehabilitation of this person stop. Rehabilitation is possible. Okay, that's the first thing. That the rehabilitation of this person is going to happen when he gets put inside a functional family, because it could very well be that his whole background is a dysfunctional family. And putting somebody from a dysfunctional family into a dysfunctional place is not going to make this person better. So I know that what could upset everybody over here is, so you're basically saying if somebody's guilty of a crime, that person then should be given a better lifestyle. No, I didn't say that. That's not what it says. What it says is this person should be put inside a functional family, and with the belief that certain mistakes of the past can be broken. Let's back up again. And just in case you're not sure yet why I mentioned that in a tziv, because I think it makes a big difference, just in terms of the way that we look at it. Rashi is seeing these as being all the details of Matan Torah. Well, the Netziv is saying that these are all the details, and then Matan Torah is going to, the Aseret HaDibrot is going to be the conclusion of everything that we're seeing over here. So just keep that in mind, and we'll try to come back to this as we move on. In the world, and it's still true today, not as much, but it's still true today, but in the ancient world, how much movement was there in terms of socioeconomic, in terms of where a person was born? I mean, essentially, most of history, most people were going to be born and going to die in the same place. I'm going to say literally, not literally in the same place. There's no movement in terms of economic growth. There was no movement in terms of social status and so on. Moreover, in ancient world, till today, literally today, there is a fear of strangers. And there are many, many issues in terms of how that stranger is to be treated. This is playing itself out of the United States right now. It's playing itself out in Israel right now. And I'm not commenting on either of those cases, but it goes back to this core about how strangers who have moved from a different place and how much they can be accepted and how much it's possible is part of the issue. We get then to the second case, which I'm not going to take any questions or comments on until I finish saying what I want to say, because there there is one level that you're going to be troubled with, and then I'm going to replace it with a second level that you're going to be troubled with, and that's not the issues. So suspend all judgment. Can you do this? Suspend all judgment. It starts off as follows. This is still in source number one, Pasuk Zayin. V'kiyam kor ish et bito. Now I know some of you are thinking, that's a good idea, right? When a person sells their daughter, I suppose too soon, v'kiyam kor ish et bito la'ama. When a person sells his daughter as a servant. Lo tzetek et zet avadim. The process that she goes through, this is not the same thing as we just now read. This is not the story of the Eved. Meaning these are not parallels. So now the first thing that you're going to find completely outrageous is the possibility that somebody can sell their daughter. So we need to be very, very careful as we continue. It says, Imra'a b'enei adoneha, asher lo ya'ada v'hefta, la'am nachui lo yimshol l'machara b'vigdo ba. So what does the words, first of all, b'vigdo ba mean? The betrayal that she went through. She was betrayed. So who betrayed her along the way? So let's again, I want to keep this very simple. Let's look at Rashi. Rashi you will find in source number 8. We're going to start towards the bottom. La'am nachri, again, the second paragraph in Rashi. La'am nachri lo yimshol l'machra, she'enu rishai l'machra la'acher, lo adon v'lo av. Nobody can turn around and sell this person. Why? Because she's not a servant. She's not a slave. But we just said she's a slave. We just said she's a servant. But no, the father doesn't own her, and then the master doesn't own her. So what in the world are we talking about? Rashi continues, Bivigdo ba, imba levgod ba, shelo lekayem ba mitzvat yi'ud. Which means that this person did not perform the mitzvah of yi'ud. Now yi'ud is a very good word. What does yi'ud mean? Destiny. Yi'ud of ad, destination. Yi'ud is destiny. That there was a certain destiny which was not just implied. What word did Rashi use? Commanded. There was a commanded destiny over here. Again. Imba levgodba shelo lekayem b'mitzvah yi'ud. Who did not fulfill the mitzvah of yi'ud? So keep one finger there and go back to the pasuk. What did the pasuk say? Imra'a b'nei adoneha asher lo ya'ada. He did not fulfill the destiny over here. Vefda la'am nechilo. Meaning, what happened here? And go back to the beginning of Rashi in source number 8 now. Rashi says, Imra'a b'nei adoneha shelo nasachem b'nei lekansa. She did not find favor in his eyes to marry her. Asher lo ye'ada, shahaya lo ye'ada. That was the purpose of all this. Lachnisa lo le'isha, to marry her. V'kesef kinyata hu kesef kidusheha. The money that was paid for this girl was the kesef kidushin. Now, by the way, this is actually a machloket in the Gemara. So let me back up a little bit. What Rashi is telling us, and he's saying this very, very clearly, he just now changed this from slavery to arranged marriage. So I know that half of you didn't like slavery and the rest of you don't like arranged marriage, but that's okay, that's okay. But I hope that you admit that arranged marriage may be a little bit better than slavery, but as I said, I want you all to reserve judgment right now. Because what Rashi is saying is that this relationship is a very different relationship than you thought. This was actually a situation where the father takes the daughter and presents her to this other person and accepts the kesef kedushin. That's what Rashi's saying. That when this person says, okay, let us be married, or whatever it is, at that point when they are married, when did the ring ever... No, that was the money that was paid initially. That's what Rashi just now said. For what purpose is this done? This is done for one purpose. And what's that? The purpose is for marriage. And if this man refuses to do this, then he has betrayed her. There is the betrayal taking place. Rashi, though, adds, and this was actually machloket in the Gemara, and Rashi says they're both right. The Gemara had an argument who the betrayal was done by. Was the betrayal done by this prospective spouse, or was it done by the father? Now go back and look at that Rashi at the end of 8. Bivigdoba imba levgodba shalola kayimba mitzvat yi'ud, that this person did not perform the mitzvah of yi'ud, of marrying this girl who he took into his home. V'chein aviyah me'achashe bagadba u'machra lezeh. The father was guilty of betrayal as well by selling this to this person. Which means what Rashi is describing over here is an arranged marriage that goes wrong. Now, why in the world would the Torah ever allow such a thing? And the answer, again, we live in a different world than existed even 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, in many, many ways. What Rashi is describing is an arranged marriage, then God bad, and it's called a betrayal. And that's very important. What exactly is behind all of this? So think for a second. Who is possibly going to be selling his daughter, somebody who has no money? Who's going to be buying somebody who has money? Do you realize what just now took place? You have a fairy tale. What's the fairy tale? This poor girl can become a princess. This poor girl can now become the wife in a very wealthy family. You have over here the elements of distribution of wealth, which means going back to what I'd said before about somebody who was born in a poor class will stay in the poor class and so on, what the Torah is describing over here, and it's not going to be the only point in the Parsha. You're going to have other examples of this where wealth gets distributed. The laws of Shemitah are going to be introduced soon. The laws where, and it's by Shemitah, it says, in order that everybody can come and eat from the produce during that year. Which means what we're going to have over here are various social structures in order to be able to break certain cycles. So the first example was the cycle of the criminal who can then, we're going to have recidivism, put the person back in prison, and no, but the Torah says no, but we believe in change. The whole purpose over here of the quote-unquote slavery is in order to promote change, to take and put it in a functioning home, see what decency is like, and then be able to re-enter society after the debt now has been paid to the person who was the victim. Society never had to take upon the finances of putting this person in prison. The person who has bought this person receives somebody who works, but the person who was the slave receives a functional family and a functional education in order to become changed. Rehabilitated. Over here, somebody who comes from a poor family, now we have an institution that this person could come, somehow be catapulted into wealth. So how did that happen? Well, that happens when the father is careful about which family and which situation is put into, and if the father does a bad job, Rashi says, you're guilty of betrayal. This can only be done in a proper way. And if the person who purchased this girl did not live up to his side of things, then he's guilty of betrayal. I can explain this a little bit more. I don't know if it's necessary. It could be that people who are wealthy are going to be prejudiced against people that are poor and say that they're lazy, they don't work hard and so on, and they're not bright. And okay, so this girl's going to come and work for you for a little bit, and you're going to see what kind of quality she really is. You're going to see what kind of wonderful person this is. But the reason to do this is in order to get to marriage. And if it doesn't get to marriage, then there is a betrayal which took place. So I'm saying, do you realize what I just now did, my two examples so far? I took slavery, I took selling off a child, and I turned them into liberal social justice, right? Which is why everybody should be upset with me. Now, nothing I've said so far is my own. Everything I think people have said before me, I want to nonetheless continue and get to another case. Source 11 is going to be interesting just in passing. Just before, I'm not going to do it too much, but the Midrash in source 11 is quoted by the Rabbeinu Bachaye in source number 10. Let's just look a little bit, and then we'll get to the next case. Source 10, Rabbeinu Bachaye writes, "Bevigdo ba, hu boged bebito, im imkoroto zulatila misha cholisaoto lisha." He has betrayed his daughter, unless he does this in a way that she will now become the wife. There's an argument. That's the beged. Rabbi Lezer Savar, Yesh Aim Limasara, Tivin Rabbi Kivim Milat Bivigdo, Miloshon Beged Mamash, Kemo, Vatifseo Bivigdo, Ulochain Markavin Sheparas Talito, Aleva, Hema Kedushin, Kinyan Shekatuv, and so on. What he's just pointing out over here, that the two words, is it beged or is it bagad, that there's an argument. Now just realize and appreciate what Rashi did. Rashi said both. Rashi just took the two opinions and claimed it was both. And that's what was really interesting, because he says both of them are guilty of the betrayal, even though it seems to be he's taking Rabbi Kiva and twisting it around a little bit. At the end, Rabbeinu Bachaye writes, of midrash v'tiim kor ish et bito la'ama, am im Yisrael ra'im. So let's just look at the midrash underneath 11. Bor ekama mushabachet parshat zu, kama parshiot ba, v'kama azharot is here Kodesh Baruch Hu Yisrael parshat zu, ki tikna eved ivi, ki mekor ish et bito la'ama, umaka aviv, ma inyun elu la'elu, amalar Kodesh Baruch Hu, li Yisrael, ani kaniti etchem b'mitzrayim be'eser makot, God says, I acquired you in Egypt. Uma inyan elu la'elu. Amalor Kodesh Baruch Hu Yisrael. Ani kaniti etchem b'mitzrayim be'eser makot. Sher e'eti shenemar nifla'im imasech. And so on. The Midrash over here is using this idea of selling the daughter and acquiring the daughter or so on, somehow connected to Am Yisrael. In the next paragraph, he's going to say, I had one daughter, and that daughter is the Torah. And it's going to again use this whole thing as a metaphor. Let's place this aside, and let's see if I have time to somehow work that back in. In source number 13, V'chiyake ish et avdo o et amato b'shevet menei tachat yado nakom yinakem. So source 13 is Perikuf Aleph Pasukuf. We've moved past the whole story of the slaves, but now we come back to the slaves. This slave over here is not an Eved Ivri. This is an Eved Kenani. This is a non-Jew who is taken as a slave. And we're told that if you beat him and he dies, then there needs to be vengeance over here. Judaism, I know that in Parshat Mishpatim, people like to compare it with the Code of Hammurabi. Over here, we're told that killing the slave is included in the Ten Commandments, in Lo Tirzach. That it's murder to kill a slave. Not only is that the case, but if you continue in Pasuk Kavav, if you knock out an eye or knock out a tooth, or for that matter, many, many other limbs as well, you cause permanent damage, then that slave goes free. So I need to stop here for a second. The slave is somebody who arguably the lowest person in the society in terms of the hierarchy. The slave is a stranger. The slave is a stranger geographically, racially, somebody who comes from completely, completely different background generally. And we're told we need to treat this person, I know you're going to say I'm overstating this, but we need to treat this person with dignity. Look at the Chizkuni in 15 when he writes, "Umeitachat yado bishat haka'ash makeu sham ad shemet, ein ze ridui elo meimit biyadayim." That's not a question of either disciplining. I know today we don't discipline this way. There was a great football player named Dick Butkus, and he said once, "What my father called discipline today, they call child abuse." Okay, so. That's not considered to be disciplining your slave or servant, but that's called murder. What it's saying over here is that if we act in a barbaric way to our slaves, who of course parenthetically we think are barbarians, and therefore it's the only language they understand, it's the only way to treat them, and so on and so forth. So look what the Torah just now said. If you treat them in a barbaric way, they become free. You no longer have a moral right to own this person. But not only do they become free, something else happens at that point. And what's that? They become a Jew of full standing. That's the process of the Eved Ivri. The Eved Ivri becomes a Jew. The Eved Kenani becomes a Jew. So over here, the Eved Kenani is somebody who is acquired, but the acquisition is one which is a very interesting acquisition, is you're taking somebody from a foreign culture, foreign land often, foreign belief system, and you bring them into this home, and then what happens along the way is there are going to be various ways for this person to become free, but one of these ways is going to be if you act in an inappropriate way with this person, you beat this person, you hurt this person, that person becomes free. And I'm going to say it again, it's as if you've acted as the barbarian, now that person has now at that point has become the Jew. So that process is one which I think is a very interesting process, but again it goes back to the same point that I've been saying from the beginning. And what's that? That obviously in Parashat Mishpatim, you know, lost among all these laws and all these details, there is this ability or this belief that there's an ability that people can change, that situations change. And therefore, even this person who was not Jewish not that long ago, now this person has become a Jew. Following along the same lines, Rashi in 14 writes, "Et ein avdo kna'ani." When we take this person into the house, the person goes through bris milah and so on, and the eved becomes a quasi Jew until they're set free, and then they become a complete convert. To know, and that's what I think becomes much more interesting about the various cases over here, is that, again, that girl that was sold, that's in order to become the wife. This person becomes a slave, that's in order to become a Jew. Exactly. The person who was guilty of a crime, that person now is exactly the transitions which are taking place. And it's the fact that we believe in those transitions, that's what's really interesting in terms of the subtext of Parshat Mishpatim. Yeah. Thank you. You'll be recorded for having said that. Nothing. What? It's okay. In this house, this person is someplace between, in the middle, between being Jewish and non-Jewish. There's another stage, which is a ger toshav. A ger toshav is a whole other story over here, who's also represented in this parsha. A ger toshav is the person who asks to live among the Jewish people and formally accepts upon themselves the Sheva Mitzvah B'nei Noach. That's what a ger toshav is. There's a whole question whether ger toshav is possible today, if it's possible on a de facto level, on a real level. What I will say is very briefly is as follows. Rav Kook, of course, we know, did not come up with the Heter Mechira. The Heter Mechira existed hundreds of years before, and it was a Sephardic minhag. It was done long before any Ashkenazim arrived over here. Okay, that's just first of all, as far as fact. They claim, I think Rav Zevin wrote it this way, that before the rabbis in Europe, Rav Yitzchak Chanan, they went searching for this book by Rabbi Rubio to find out, and then he dealt with a case where a Jew in the Hebron area owns some vineyards, and if he didn't work it for the whole year, he was afraid that the whole vineyard would fall apart. So then he said, okay, so sell it for 2 years. Whatever. But when Rav Kook was writing, so again, just to make this a little bit more of the history understandable without the whole story, when the first groups of Jews who started to work in agriculture came to Israel, so one of the first ones was Maaseret Batya, and the whole question came, what's going to happen by Shemitah? And they kept the first Shemitah, and people died. Just to understand very clearly, people died. By the second Shemitah, the rabbis already went and said, okay, you need to do the Het to Mechira, so the person, you need to do something, otherwise people are going to die. So they arranged for the rabbi of Yafo, who was a rabbi, Levi was his name. He was a great Kabbalist. Many of the Kabbalistic writings of the Vilna Gaon were published by this Rabbi Levi. His great-great-grandson, Davin's in my shul. And I could tell you some very, very interesting stories, but Rabbi Levi was the one who did it because he was the rabbi of Yafo, which was the area where a lot of these farms were. When Rabbi Levi died, then Rav Kook replaced him, and he became the rabbi of Yafo. So therefore, Rav Kook essentially inherited the Heter Mechira as the job of the rabbi of Yafo, the rabbi of the various kibbutzim and moshevot and so on. So when Rav Kook then tried to defend it, he wrote a whole book, Shabbat Haaretz. But in the book, one of the things that he had a hard time with was, how can you sell the land of Israel? So what he tried to then say was that you can sell it to somebody who's a ger toshav. There's no prohibition of selling a ger toshav. He's allowed to have a place in the land. But the question is, can you be formally a ger toshav today? One of the problems, by the way, is that there's a Tosfot that indicates, I mean, it's based upon the Gemara, but it indicates that a ger toshav, Tosfot actually rules this way, a ger toshav has to keep Shabbat. And that may seem very strange, because you can't keep Shabbat. Don't we say a goyo keeps Shabbat? A ger toshav keeps Shabbat in terms of working for us. Ger toshav cannot be a Shabbos guy. So therefore, Rav Kook then had to explain how you can sell the land of Israel to a Muslim, and that's okay because they're ger toshav, but on the other hand, you can still ask a Muslim to become a Shabbos guy for you. Because you know, at the same time, if you're going to be consistent, then you would have to say both of these things. If you look for a moment at source number 18, Pasuk Yud Bet, Sheshet Yamim Tasem Ma'asecha, Uviyom Ashvi Tishpot, Laman Yenuach Shorcha V'chomerecha, V'yinafesh Ben Amatcha V'hager. So who is this ger being referred to in this Pasuk? So this ger is the ger toshav. The ger toshav is one who rests as well, but he rests with for us. I can't have him doing my work. So, you know, again, parenthetically, this past Shemitah, the Heter Mechira, when it was done, they sold the land to somebody for the first time who was not a Muslim. And I don't know if this is a good story or a bad story, but they sold it to a person from Jewish-Russian identity, who, namely, his father or grandfather was Jewish and came here, I believe served in the army, accepted the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, but in terms of the state of Israel, in terms of the Beit Din, he was not Jewish because his mother wasn't Jewish. So, but he stood in front of a Beit Din and said, I accept the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach. So therefore, it was claimed that this was a real Ger Toshav. So the whole objection to the Heter Mechira, or at least one of the objections, fell apart this last year, and it was barely publicized at all because people, I mean, because it's politics. And I won't say anything more about this now, but before we get, God willing, before the next Shemitah, we will talk about it much, much more. But I will say that the Heter Mechira was better in this past Shemitah, arguably, than it was for the last 50, 60 years. Okay, let me continue. A couple psukim before this, it says, "V'ger lo tilchatz," pasuk tet, source 18, perek kaf gimel, pasuk tet. "V'ger lo tilchatz," don't put pressure on the ger. "V'tem yadata b'nefesh ager," ki gerim hayitim beretz Mitzrayim. So, who is this ger that we're talking about? This one is actually the real convert, as it were. This ger, as opposed to Pasuk Yud Bet, by Pasuk Yud Bet, Rashi says in 22, Vahager, Ger Toshav. This Ger is what we call a Ger Tzedek. The Ger Tzedek is somebody who you need to treat in a different kind of way because you were Gerim. Now, the very possibility of a Ger means that we believe that people change. We believe that there's a possibility for radical transformations. If we'll follow through the other themes of the parsha, then you have somebody who may very well have been at some point an Eved Kanani, and the Eved Kanani then becomes this Ger, and now he's a full-standing Jew, and the Torah is telling us that you know what it was like. Now, when I read that pasuk the first time, and the 10th time, and the 50th time, it always meant the same thing to me. What it meant was the Ger has a sense of loneliness. The Ger has left their home, left their family. Probably knows what it's like to be a Ole Chadash over here. I'm just kidding. No, but there is... My parents moved here after our third child was born, between the third and the fourth. So those first three children were born where all the Israelis would go from the maternity ward to their mother's home. Right? That's just what they did. That's like what the grandchildren do now. They go to their mother. They move in with the mother. So, but, I mean, first of all, when my son was born, he was the only one who was blonde in the whole ward. It was very easy to pick him out. But basically the only one going home as opposed to going, yeah, to Safta, to family. And there is this difference. Again, the living in Israel as a quote-unquote an Olech Hadash, I can't say that 35 years later, but as an Olech Hadash, is an experience where very often one is accepted by the larger community, by neighbors and by friends and by people, because that's the kind of people it is. But the Ger often feels different. Now, whether it's real or not, I can't tell you. And it may be an existential... Yeah, there's this feeling of being different. And I always understood this more in this existential way, in the feeling that the person has. And then I read the Alshech over here in Source 19, because I think the Alshech over here completely encapsulates everything I've been trying to say today. He writes, "V'ger lo tuchatz, ki hine atem yadatem et nefesh ager, shehu kekatan shenolad." A ger is a new person. A ger has nothing to do with that background. You can't judge the ger for anything that happened before they became that ger because they are a new person. That this person now has a new soul. And don't judge them by anything in their past, where they're from, or anything else about them. Because you know that this person is as if they're reborn, as it were. Also a phrase we can't use. So, again, I always say that we were strangers there. We were maltreated. We were... Kisham hayitim ovdei avoda zara. he incorporates the teaching that we left to the lowest level there, that we were Ovdei Avodah Zarah, v'nitgayartim, v'yitim k'toshim v'dam Pesach v'dam Milah. Hineki nefesh agir tova milev minefesh, v'lamatich shavu l'ramai. Why are you suspecting them? Why are you guilty of xenophobia? Because you, not just were a stranger, again, it's not existential. You were transformed. Which means this is a whole twist on the whole Pesach story, and therefore it's a twist on the Pesach story and standing at Har Sinai. And maybe that's the reason why I just found the Netziv so interesting. What is he telling us? What is the Alshach saying? He's saying is that, do we believe there's a possibility that people can transform? Well, we better, because that's our story. Our story is really a story which is very fairy tale-ish. We were the damsels in distress. We were at the lowest level of the social strata. We were the Ovdei Avodah Zarah. We were very, very poor. We were non-believers. And we became transformed, and we stood at Har Sinai, and we accepted the Torah, and we were all reborn at that moment. So therefore, what this is saying is, yes, you better believe in the ability of transformation, of rehabilitation, of change, because that's our story. That's exactly what's going on over here. So, and I'll say it again now, and then for the Netziv, all of this then introduces us to the Aseret Dibrot, when God says, Anochi Hashem, who took you out of the land of slavery. Because realize, that's what this whole thing is about. And again, I don't think it makes that much of a difference if, like Rashi says, this happens afterwards or before, but what I do think this is a whole nother read on Parshat Mishpatim, because it's very easy to get caught into all the minutiae of the laws and in all of the torts and in all of the technicalities and so on. But there's a subtext here. And the subtext over here is, yes, people mess up and people are low, but people can come high. And people can make mistakes, but people can be healed. And people can come from a very modest background and people can be completely transformed away. And what we have over here, again, I'm not going to call it so much a liberal philosophy, but we have over here is a very optimistic philosophy in terms of this ability of change to take place and not to stigmatize and not to judge people in their past and not to judge people by their mistakes, because of course things can change. And that person who is guilty of a crime does not have to remain the criminal. And that girl who was born in a very poor family can end up becoming a woman who's the head of a very wealthy household. And that person who was born a non-Jew, especially if you treat them in a wrong way, that person now could become a Jew because you maltreated them. And that's what's really interesting. And for that matter, when you look at the person who became a Jew, just realize that you went through the exact same process. We went through that exact same process. This is not his story. This is our story. And therefore, this is the people that we are, which means that there is something, despite all the boring laws over here, and I apologize, despite all the boring laws and all the technical things over here, there's something about Parashat Mishpatim underneath the surface which is incredibly optimistic. And it's saying that there's this belief that people can change. There's this belief that people become great. And all that we need to remember is that we were once slaves and look who we became. And as I said, this may be, according to the Netziv, the introduction which then allows us to stand at Har Sinai and then for us to be converted and for us to be changed and for us to say the Na'aseh V'Nishma and for us to then to become true Jews. Because to become a true Jew, you need to believe that there really is greatness in people and that we really do live a fairy tale.